G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Cheryl Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, we're back with another podcast, and pleased to say we had plenty of downloads on the last one, so good to know that you're really enjoying that. And if there's any topics you would like us to discuss, please let us know at notthefootyshow.com or on our Facebook page. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And we've got two topics to talk about as usual today, but we've also got a really special guest. Today we're catching up with Andy Halliday, who's the team manager of Great Britain Hockey and also England Hockey. And he's doing something, John, that I'd like to see you attempt, actually, that he is going to dribble a hockey ball 200 miles.
Yeah, I wouldn't have done that in my career in total, I don't think.
And they're looking. He's part of the Hockey for Heroes squad, and what they're going to do is they're attempting to travel 200 miles, play 30 hockey matches in just 10 days. And the whole idea is to raise money for ex-servicemen, and they're also going to have carrying a serviceman on a stretcher that 200 kilometres as well. Sorry, 200 miles. From Cardiff to London. So a great effort for a really good cause, but we'll hear more from him later in the show. Am I starting us off today?
Did you? I think you started last week, didn't you?
I did. So you can go first. Turn.
Okay. A-League Grand Final on the weekend. And in the aftermath of it, a lot was made of the viewing figures for that particular game and how much of a success it was for the broadcasters and for the FFA. So I thought I'd have a look at those figures and try and put them into some perspective. Now, this is not an FFA bashing exercise. It's more of trying to put it into context what Australian sport faces when it comes to signing broadcast rights deals. And because that seems to be the thing that's driving Australian sport at the moment is broadcast money. That's the only thing that's keeping a lot of Australian sport alive. Now, bear with me for a sec because I have to turn around to look at the other computer. But to give you an idea, now, according to the Oztam figures, the top 20 programs on all multi-channels, so that's not your main 7, 9, 10, this is your 7 mates, your 22s, that sort of thing.
All on your set-top box.
Yeah, the multi-channels, yep. Right? The number one on the multi-channels was the A-League Grand Final post-match. Very important to keep that in mind, post-match. Now, according to the Oztam, 254,000 people across the country tuned in on SBS, the delayed coverage, to their post-match. The second most watched program on the multi-channels was Iron Man 3, that got 180,000. And then, coming in at number 3, is the A-League Grand Final. The actual broadcast of the grand final, not the post-match, which included
the extra
time and penalty shootout. So we're just talking the 90 minutes of the match. Now, the 90 minutes of the match on SBS2 got 182,000 viewers. Now, when you go down to Foxtel and have a look at their figures, we'll just go down. The number one rating show on Foxtel on Sunday night was the A-League post-game. So once again, the grand final post game, your extra time. The second most watched program was the grand final itself. Now on Foxtel, 460,000 people watched the post game. As for the match itself, only 213,000 watched the match, the 90 minutes of the game
was
supposed
doubled.
To be. More than doubled. Now what that says is that while people were interested in the result, they weren't interested in watching the game. Oh, there's a penalty shootout on. Oh, it's an extra time. Let's click over there and catch the exciting final few minutes, shall we? And that, I think, is a real problem for football. And when it's going to be asking broadcasters to sign big free-to-air rights TV deals. Now, just consider this for a second. If you go back to the highest rating shows on Australian television, full stop, on any channel, you come up with 7 News, it got 1.1 million. You've got The Voice, which was up against the A-League Grand Final directly on the East Coast. They got 1.08 million. 9 News got 1.05 million. House Rules on Channel 7 got 780,000. MasterChef got 760,000. 60 Minutes got 715,000. Sunday Night, 658,000. Even Grantchester on the ABC got 624,000 viewers. Now, where does that put the A-League Grand Final in perspective? So, I really think that when commentators are talking about what a wonderful occasion it was for the FFA, it's got to be tempered by the fact that it was wonderful for the people that were interested in it, but there was a lot of people that had no interest in it whatsoever, out of the football public, that showed no interest in it.
I agree. I think that those figures are really worrying, especially when you put them into context. The population of Australia, 24.29 million is the latest figure. I looked it up before we came on air. That's why I know it. I'm not a nerd and know that off the top of my head. But also the fact that in December of 2016, the figures that were released were that there are 1.086 million people in Australia playing football. So if you look at that, you're not even getting all of them watching the A-League Grand Final, which is your showcase event in the sport that all these people are playing. In fact, you're not even getting close to getting all of those people watching. And that is a concern. I think football is in... I've said it for a long time. I think it's in a lot of trouble in that the current A-League structure, people are bored with it. Certainly all the people I know in football are bored with it. They want to see more teams. They want to see them less playing against each other. That we have, you know, these three times a season is just kind of... just goes nowhere. And then six teams in the finals campaign is just ludicrous. I really don't agree with that at all. Never have done in a 10-team league. I think that's just ridiculous. You don't even have to be half as good as everybody and you're in the grand final. Win three games and you're the champion of Australia. So that needs to be seriously looked at. To be fair, though, this year the best two teams were in the grand final. Those figures are terrible. And I think it shows people have just got bored with it. I got in an argument with someone from Fox who was saying they felt the A-League was in a better position than it had been for years. I don't agree. I think it's been declining over the last 4 or 5 years. I think that it peaked, in my opinion. I thought the marketing was there. Everything was there. Was the razzmatazz at the beginning. But I think about season 4 or 5 was when it peaked in quality. And what worries me is when you see players like Thomas Broich and people complaining that here's a guy who's 36, 37 and that Brisbane Roar are going to let him go. He shouldn't still be a standout player at that age, I'm sorry to say. Shouldn't be, but he is. Tim Cahill coming back at his age shouldn't be a standout player in this league if the league is any good. Yet Tim Cahill still has a massive impact on the way things went this season in the games that he played. And so, to me, that questions the talent that is there and the actual standard of the football.
Just one more figure for you. I mentioned on the delayed telecast on SBS Viceland got 182,000 of the game proper, the 90 minutes of the game proper. That was up against Shaun the Sheep on ABC that managed to pull in 156,000 viewers, of which I admit I was one. Now... That should be really ringing alarm bells for the FFA and other sports administrators. One thing I couldn't find in the figures was how netball did. And that is a real worry for netball because they've got this wonderful coverage on free-to-air. They're very lucky to have it. I'm sure they appreciate it immensely. But it's not translating for them. And they've signed big pay deals with people and players promise the world on the back of being able to show it on free-to-air television. Now... free-to-air television isn't free. There's a price to be paid. And if you don't get viewers, that price is you're going to be gone. You're not going to be shown on free-to-air TV. And netball's really got to do something to shore that up because they have promised so much based on the fact that they were going to be on TV.
I think the worrying thing, John, and you've kind of alluded to it, you've gone into it and you've then come back out of it, is the fact that we've talked about this for a very long time, and there was always going to be a time where the money bubble in sport and what broadcasters were prepared to pay for sporting rights was going to burst. Now, I'm fortunate that I freelance, so I work for a number of television stations around the world. Now, some of those have told me that they are culling production. They are now outsourcing their production because they cannot afford to do the production. You're seeing more and more of them are turning around and saying, we are not paying that. We paid that for those rights now. We will not pay that again because we cannot make money on that deal. Because the thing is, as I've said, with especially with the pay stations, what happens is they base their on the subscriptions they will get and the revenue they would generate from their subscriptions by buying, say, the English Premier League. But if they've got the English Premier League, they have maxed out probably, or they're not going to get a huge increase on their subscriptions if they renew that contract. So they're not going to make money there. Then there comes down to, okay, then they have to make money from their advertising. But again, if the advertising and the global economy is not good, advertisers can't spend more than they can afford and more than the market demands that they can afford to pay. And so you're seeing a lot of issues there where companies are going, well, look, if you're going to charge me that, I can't afford to pay it. So then they're just going, they cannot possibly make money from it. So you're going to see, I think you're going to see salaries in sport coming down. I think certainly in football globally, these, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds a week, these guys playing now will be the last generation to demand those sort of wages because television will not pay that. And if you go to online screening of games, the money is not going to be there because people are now more discernible. They want to watch. They're also, their attention span, again, and this is not my saying, this is figures given by people in the business. And they're saying, people flick stations. They no longer, if they, like the A-League was boring, they'll flick and see what's on another channel. They'll come back to it. They surf. So they don't stick and watch a game all the way through. And again, this is a problem because the advertisers don't get the benefit. I mean, what do? The minute an ad comes on, you change channel.
For a lot of people, that's true. Yeah, definitely. And especially in an environment where you are getting the players demanding as much as they are, and especially with women's sport, because they're trying to get equity and equality with men. But that's not factored into the finances of the game, that you're going to be paid that much money. And that's essentially what is happening with netball. We saw the case where the players were threatening to go on strike. And they were threatening to go on strike because they considered the person that was going to protect their financial interests the best was going to get voted off the board, and all of what they thought they had worked hard to gain was going to be rolled back on them. And it is going to get rolled back on you, girls, because the money's not going to be there. The figures aren't there for the viewers. So the advertisers aren't going to pay for it, and you're not going to be able to sustain the model you're trying to pursue.
And this is where you've hit, again, a very key point, is the players' representatives have got to start waking up and be realistic, and they've got to start telling the people that they represent, the players, that what they expect now is no longer achievable. So they need to tailor their expectations a little bit more to the realism of what is going on in the world, that the money is not there. It's not an endless cash cow that you can just continually go and take money from.
And the Australian sporting landscape in that sense has been bastardised by the Australian AFL and NRL, because every other sport athlete sees that as, well, why aren't I being recompensed in the same way these guys are doing? I'm just as much of an athlete. I train just as hard. I put just as much into it. So as long as there's those players or those athletes being getting those sorts of rewards in this country, every other athlete's going to expect it as well.
I'll give you an example, though, John, again, where costs are being cut in television. And there's even new technology now that is going to be used, I believe, at the Commonwealth Games by a lot of people where they're not actually going to have live commentary there. These commentators are going to be in studios doing it off the tube, just as it was done with the Olympics over here, yep. Which I could not believe that they won a Logie for the coverage of the Olympics, Channel 7. But my word, yeah, I was...
You're kidding me.
You had to pick me off the floor with that one.
You are kidding.
No, I'm serious. I was just... Somebody told me, and I literally was speechless.
Don't pay attention to the Logies normally.
But what is happening, though? So again, and people may think, oh, that's not going to impact on me in my living room. Trust me, it does, because when you're doing... And I've had to commentate games off the television... And the problem is, all you're getting is the view you're getting. So you cannot see in certain things a run being made up a left wing or something, and then the ball is played across because you're stuck in a studio. So you don't get the vision of what is actually unfolding in a game because you're restricted to what is on your monitor. And it's the same thing. thing often in athletics. If they're focused on the front guys at the of a pack running, you're not going to see a guy coming up from behind making a sudden burst as easily. So suddenly the description you're getting from your commentator is very different to, and your viewing experience will become very different in your living room as well.
You know what, especially in this digital age, and we've seen it with the coverage of it was the boxing, the Danny Green Mundine fight with people streaming it on social media. If television stations are going to start doing that and just having some bloke sitting in Sydney watching a TV screen calling a game from England, then other people are going to start doing exactly the same thing and streaming it on their own feeds and doing their own commentaries. Because essentially, you're going to get the same thing. It won't matter whether you're watching the official broadcaster or not. And they won't be able to stop people doing that on social media. They just won't be able to stop
it. We had problems at the Sultan Aslan Shah Cup in that there were people there with media accreditation filming the game. And Astro Arena, who I was working for, they had to actually get their staff to go up and say, look, excuse me, we've paid X million for the rights.
Absolutely.
You know, if we prosecute you, you're going to have to compensate us, but just please turn your camera off.
There was a time in Australia where the wonderful Roy Slaven and H.G. Nelson used to do their grand final commentaries, and they did it off the box. And it wasn't a straight-up commentary. Everybody knows that. It was a bit of a joke and ha-ha. But that will become the format for other people like Roy and HG to do that. You know, there'll be a couple of dudes sitting in a shed very similar to this who'll just watch a game of soccer and just talk and just play that on the internet. And you won't need to listen to the television station anymore. You can just watch it straight off the net.
Now, well, going back to your point, I think those figures, now you've revealed them, are a little bit worrying rather than something to celebrate.
Hi, I'm Daniel Ricciardo, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, well, as we said, we have one special guest on the show this time around. And on the 20th of May, the Hockey for Heroes squad are going to be attempting to challenge themselves in their greatest way yet. They're going to look to complete 200 miles and 30 hockey matches in 10 days. Now, they're going to be carrying an ex-serviceman on a stretcher from Cardiff to London, and Andy Halliday, our guest, is going to be trying to dribble a hockey ball behind the stretcher for those 200 miles. He does tell me in the interview he's not going to be playing in all of the games, but still, I think the pressure on his body to do that is going to be phenomenal. Now, he was training in Ipoh on the treadmill at the hotel, just jogging with a hockey stick and a hockey ball, and I'll try and get the video clip. Yeah. And he couldn't do it in the street, so I will try and get that clip up onto our Facebook page as well, just so you can all see that. But I think you're going to enjoy this catch up with a very special man. Andy Halliday, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Hi.
Well, we're talking to you here in Ipoh because we've heard of a lot of people doing strange things for charity, but dribbling a hockey ball thousands of miles seems a really crazy one when you think how much pressure players put on their hips and their back.
Well, it's not really thousands of miles, but it's still quite a long distance. I mean, I think the plan is to dribble 200 miles in 10 days across the UK. That's the plan. And I'm doing it for a charity called Hockey for Heroes. Charity's been around for about 10 years. They support our services personnel, particularly those that have come back from Afghanistan with physical and mental health issues. So it's a great cause. It's a group of about 30 or 40 guys and girls who play hockey socially around the UK.
And you've done, though, this dribbling challenge a few times, I believe, already, haven't you?
I have, yeah. I like to think that I invented the sport of extreme hockey dribbling. I mean, does it exist as a sport? I doubt it, because I sort of started it off. It started, actually, over the normal thing you'd sort of expect, a couple of beers and a bet. So we'd had a couple of beers, I think it was at one of the hockey dinners somewhere in London, in early 2012. And myself and Jason Lee, the then GB men's coach, decided that we would dribble the London Marathon, and that's how it began. So we dribbled the London Marathon and raised, I think we raised about, between us, about £9,000 for charity. It was very different, and we were very concerned, of course, that loads of people had trained for the London Marathon for years, and there we were, you know, with a stick and a hockey ball. So you had to keep the ball quite close to your body. We both got round in about 5.5 hours, which isn't bad. And then having done that, you sort of think, right, what's the next challenge? So we moved on, and to 2014, myself and John Bleeby, who's one of the GB assistant men's coaches, decided we do something a little bit perverse, and that was to dribble the three peaks. So in the UK, we've got Ben Nevis, Snowdon and Scafell Pike, which are the threest peaks in England, Scotland and Wales. I mean, you know, we're not talking Andes, Himalayas, Alps here.
No,
we're talking about 4,500 feet for Ben Nevis. So we dribbled up and down all three over 3 days. We were considering doing it, you know, in one. So we dribble one, drive to the next, dribble one, drive to the next. But dribbling in the dark, we tried it. You can't do it. So we got through that and again raised a shed load for charity, which was great, which is what it's all about. And then got interested in the Hockey for Heroes, this event that they're running, which is called Operation Stretcher. And these guys are a bit off the wall. What they're trying to do, as I say, 200 miles Cardiff to London, but they're stopping at 10 hockey clubs over the 10 days. And they're going to play three games back-to-back each day. But on top of that, they are carrying a stretcher with a former Royal Marine who was injured in a winter training accident. They're carrying him on the stretcher, the 200 miles. So it's 20 miles a day with a stretcher, three games of hockey, repeat 10 times. And I've said I'll dribble the stretcher, dribble my hockey ball behind the stretcher for the 200 miles.
It's unbelievable to just hear that. And I don't know which is going to be harder, the stretcher guys or you actually having to go at their pace dribbling behind. Or do you accelerate ahead of them, or is there a pace you have to keep?
I think I'll tuck in behind the peloton. That'll be my plan. The peloton. Yeah, absolutely. The peloton will be the stretcher. We've actually trained quite a bit for this. And the guys, we've been out over a couple of weekends now with the stretcher. And there's no doubt, I think these guys, it's tough for them. There's a group of, there's basically going to be about 40 of us, including support staff, 28, 30 players, and they will rotate on the stretcher every few minutes. So they're going to be working in teams of four. But that, you know, having seen them do it, that is going to be hard because they're carrying it down by the side. And as I say, you know, my simple job is just to dribble a hockey ball all the way.
But Albert, I saw on Facebook you were saying you've been unable to practice here in Ipoh. The streets are not that smooth and the pavements aren't that great.
I love Malaysia, but there's something I would say about if you're not motorised, you don't feel welcome on the roads. It's a bit more dangerous here than the UK. So I tried a little bit of an experiment up in the gym in the hotel and got on the treadmill with a stick and ball. And actually... Listeners, you should go and try this. I mean, it's actually doable. You know, you can actually do it. So, not very quick, and you have to concentrate all the time. Otherwise, you could end up, you know, going through the plate glass window in front of the treadmill if you're not careful. But, so to get my training in, because this is all about getting the mileage in, really, and being on my feet for 3 or 4 hours a day. And it's a bit difficult to do out here. It's easier in the UK.
I did joke about your hips and your back, but players suffer with that, and you must ache at the end of a day.
Yeah, I do, but actually I played, you know, I started playing hockey at the age of four, and I stopped playing at 40. And it was a mixture of pressure of my career, but also the fact I could feel my hips and my back. It was starting to cause me a few issues, and I stopped, and I was very much part of the playing years where AstroTurfs had first been laid, and they were laid on concrete. So if you like, my sort of era of 1980s, 1990s hockey players were probably the ones that were the experimental guinea pigs on AstroTurf. So I stopped at 40, but I always wanted firstly to give something back to the game, but secondly to carry on in some way. I'm involved in hockey, team manager of Great Britain, coach of the England indoor team, so I'm still doing a lot of work with hockey. But keeping yourself active with stick and ball is actually, this is a good way of doing it for me.
No, a fantastic way of doing it. I mean, if there's any sort of guys from the UK that are listening to this podcast, I mean, can they donate? We'll just get the who to go just to show we are at a real game. But yeah, how can they donate if they want to get behind what you're trying to do?
So the charity is called Hockey for Heroes. We have a website page, www.hockeyforheroes. We also have a Just Giving page, and it's the Hockey for Heroes team, and it's known as Op Stretcher. And I'm Andy Halliday. I think I'm Andrew Halliday 5. So if you find the page and you can donate, and I think we're looking. I mean, we are aiming for this to be the biggest yet. I think we've just passed about £12,000, and I think we're going to aim to try and get up to over 30 if we can.
Fantastic. Now, you're not playing in these games after dribbling, are you?
No, I've sort of been excused. It's quite subtle, actually, because I've sort of offered to umpire, meaning that they want me to play, but I've just, because I haven't played for 15 years, and because it would, there's no doubt it would threaten my ability to dribble at 200 miles. So I shall be doing a bit of coaching, doing a bit of organising, a bit of umpiring, but very much on the sidelines.
Now, you were telling me, though, you're not allowed to go actually into London. There's a little few security fears for that. So you're going to finish, was it Chiswick?
Out to Marlow. We're going to finish in Marlow, which is west of western London, very near Bisham Abbey, where the GB hockey team are based. The recent events, obviously, we have quite a few former Army and current Army and services personnel within the Hockey for Heroes group. And we are, you know, a services unit, the guys, some of the attire that the guys wear. And the recent events in Westminster and the current global situation has really meant that we need to steer clear of central London. We don't want to be looking over our shoulders. You know, we want to be raising money and enjoying the experience. So we're not going into central London anymore. We'll finish with a real good party day at Marlow Hockey Club, just outside London, and that will be a great way to wrap it up.
And any thoughts to come and dribble across Australia?
Well, I've got a pathological fear of snakes. I'm not sure you'll find me dribbling across Australia. There's a couple of things that have been mentioned. One was John O'Groats to Land's End, which is obviously the length of the I'm 55 though, actually. That's the thing, you know, I can't keep doing this every year. Somebody's got to take it over. But the other one that sort of interests me, and again this is really perverse, but it interests me, is dribbling to Everest Base Camp.
Now that would be interesting.
That would be very interesting, but is it a pipe dream? Let's get this one out of the way first.
Well, Andy, great catching up with you, and all the very best.
Thanks, Ash.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Jacobi from Germany, playing for the Delhi Wave Riders. You're hearing Not the Footy Show.
And a very appropriate that we have Nicholas Jacobi, who, of course, is now retired from the international scene, but Andy Halliday, well, I think what he's trying to attempt, John, is fantastic. I don't envy him trying to dribble a hockey ball 200 miles at all.
Yeah, what sort of roads will he be travelling down?
Well, they're not allowed to do it on the motorway, so it's all the sort of major roads, but I think they're looking at sort of A and B roads in England.
I'd be picking everything that's got brand new asphalt laid on it. Nice and smooth, and easy.
He did sort of explain to me some of the route that they're going, and I actually know some of those roads because it's my part of the world. And so the roads do tend to fall away into the sort of scrub at the side. But for those of you who are interested, they leave from Sophia Gardens in Cardiff on the 26th of May, and then they're playing at Gloucester City Hockey Club, Chippenham Hockey Club, Royal Wootton Bassett Hockey Club, where my mother used to live and my sister lives, Newbury Hockey Club, Sonning, Amersham and Chalfont, I think it is, Hockey Club, St Albans, which is Andy's home club, Old Loughton's, and Marlow is the final one. If you want more information, you can go to the hockeyforheroes.co.uk website. And if you'd like to contribute to Andy and his quest to raise money for the Hockey for Heroes, you can go to www.justgiving.com/fundraising/Andrew-Halliday5. So I will put that on the post when we put it up on Facebook and also on the website. So if you don't catch it there, you can get it then. My topic now.
Yes, your turn.
Okay, I'm turning my attention to the news from the International Athletics that they are looking to wipe the board of all of the records, world records set previous to 2005. And I have to say that I think it is one of the most preposterous idea, or even preposterous ideas, I've ever heard. In that, I understand that you couldn't keep up with the drug enhancements that were coming into sport and you were unable to police them, so therefore some of the records are questionable, but some of the records are legitimate, and therefore you do not have the right to besmirch the reputation of those people who haven't done anything wrong. And again, also, what's the case when it's innocent until proven guilty? Now, there are people that have suspicions, but you never caught them, so you cannot say that they cheated. And where does this end? I mean, if athletics does this, are we going to go back through all the World Cup football matches and go, well, there was a penalty given there and we can now see that he dived, or it was actually outside the box, so that penalty doesn't count, so we're going to actually now reverse the decision and we're going to give it to the losing finalist? Or are we going to go into cricket matches where a catch was grounded or the batsman didn't actually edge the ball? And then does it go into music where, you know, we've had rock stars awarded Grammys, etc., yet they've written their music while fueled with drugs, and suddenly we're going to have to go, well, sorry, no, you actually composed that under the influence of some pretty illicit drugs there, so now you have to be clean to actually qualify for this award.
Although, having said that, I would like to see Manchester United versus Chelsea and all of the players on LSD. That would be a football game worth watching.
You do have a different imagination to me, John, I have to say. But no, look, I just think this is ridiculous. And, you know, it's good that some of the athletes have come out against it. Some have come out in favour of it. Asafa Powell is one who says he thinks it's a good idea. But, I mean, Paula Radcliffe, the former British long-distance runner, she's against it. And then you've got American star Alison Felix. She's against it as well. And I just think, you know, we don't know who was cheating, so you have no proof on a lot of these. So it's just going to have to stand. And sure, there are question marks over some of those performances. But if you take, for example, John, and I thought about this after I read this, it was Bob Beamon. His long jump record stood for so long. There's never been any accusation levelled at him. There's never been any even suspicion. But then suddenly, because his record stood for so long, would we now be saying, well, it had to be drug affected?
No, why would you say that?
Yeah, but this is what I feel the IAAF are actually looking at.
Let's go back to our interview we did some time ago with Ralph Dobell. And Ralph talked about the fact in that interview that the modern Australian athletes were essentially useless because none of them could break his time. And they had every advantage that he never had as a runner, and yet they still couldn't break his time in an era where full of athletes taking drugs, and also in an era where records were tumbling. Australian athletes still couldn't run better than him. Now, what does that say about drug taking, really?
Well, look, I think you'll find Peter Norman in the 1968 Olympic Games, his record is still the fastest time, yeah, by Australian as well. So we're going back 1968.
And as Ben Johnson said, you know, okay, I did take drugs, but drugs didn't get me there. I didn't win because I took drugs. I had to do everything else. I did all the training. I did everything that every other athlete did, but I just did this little bit on top as well. So you don't get to those places and to set those records without doing the work, full stop, anyway. You know, it's...
I mean, look, we've had this argument as well. Is then, you know, if you look at it, is cortisone a performance-enhancing drug?
Because absolutely.
A lot of players wouldn't get out there without a shot of cortisone. So therefore, it is a performance-enhancing drug.
Most
so
definitely.
Suddenly, are you going to have to now go back and look at all of the athletes that had a cortisone shot before they went out and ran in a race or took part in a sporting event?
Now, recently we've seen, that leads into an interesting point, the use of drugs, because recently we've seen in the NRL a little bit of a problem with the cocaine, it appears, in NRL. Maybe it's just a fluke that the only four blokes who take the drug got caught on the same weekend, but I probably doubt it. And there's reasons, there's easy reasons to understand why athletes might be turning to drugs like cocaine to have some fun, because a lot of the other things that people take to have fun that are legal, they're told they shouldn't take. Okay, the other thing about athletes is they are in a culture that says drugs are okay, and you just mentioned it then, the use of cortisone. They take blokes off the field at quarter time or half time or whatever time they want, they come off injured, give them a jab and send them back out there. And the message they are sending them is that drugs are actually okay. It becomes part of the culture that they live in. You know, they take pills and all sorts of weird supplements and all those sorts of things. So they live in a world where drugs is okay. It's part of the normal routine of life.
Well, you mentioned the supplements, and if you look at how many of the Australian sporting teams are sponsored by Swiss, you know, a sort of, again, a company that has dubious reputation and admits that it spends more money on advertising than it does on medical research, and the main person that vouches for it is the father of the founder of the company, who is a doctor. So, I mean, here is a really dubious product.
Yeah.
And again, I've spoken to Socceroos or former Socceroos who've played in Italy, and they've been told that, you know, before a game over there, they would come around with these vitamins at the hotel and say, okay, this is to get you through the game. And this particular player said he used to put it under his tongue until the guy had gone and then just spit it out, because he goes, I had no idea what they were giving me, and I'd had no idea whether it was legal, and he goes, I had no idea what the side effects were. But he goes, a lot of the players were just taking them.
Oh, absolutely they would. Because a lot of players, too, go in to these organisations at very young, and they place their trust in them wholly. You know, the organisations look after them, they make sure they get to training on time, they do X, Y, Z, they make sure they eat whatever foods. I mean, I'm sure a lot of them have their diet sorted out for them. They don't even have to think about what they're going to have to eat. It's all done. So it's no surprise that athletes will just blindly accept what's given to them and just take it.
Well, I don't think they should blindly accept this ruling or proposal by the IAAF.
Well, it's completely insane and just stupid. And when you consider the IAAF has a terrible, terrible track record at actually catching drug cheats. I mean, the most famous drug cheats in sport haven't been caught by the IAAF.
No, I'm so. Trying to remember the name of the woman, the famous case, wasn't it? She won, it was in the 30s or 40s. Where she won Olympic gold medals in the sprint events, and there was always a question whether she was actually a he, and it was only then when years later she got
her autopsy, wasn't it?
Yeah, she got caught in the crossfire of a bank robbery in America and got killed, and it was only then that they found out that all those years she had actually been a man.
Yeah, that's and that's going to be more of a problem in the future as more and more people who, you know, that sort of thing becomes more acceptable. People's sexuality is almost you can choose it these days if you so desire. But and that will cause other problems as well when it comes to drug testings and things like that. But it's just a dumb idea, and it sounds to me it's just like administrators trying to cover their ass.
Yeah, look, you know my feeling on a lot of administrators.
Yes, I do.
That's a whole nother debate. I'll be on this again. Now, we haven't had a Phil Collins award for people that have missed again, but I have to have a pop at the national broadcaster. I don't always watch their news on the television, but the other night, John, turned on the sports section. It's not the longest sports section anyway, and they ran with a story about the women's AFL not being expanded. Then they went on to a story about the Fremantle Dockers. Then we had Eugenie Bouchard beating Maria Sharapova. And then what do we go back to? Another story about the women's AFL. Now you think, this is, in the scheme of things, in the scheme of women's sport, it is a blip in the ocean. Like, there are bigger, the netball's bigger than women's AFL. The W League is bigger than women's AFL. It's like, give me a break. What are you getting backhanders to promote this league from the AFL? Because there is something clearly going on, that there are all these media outlets that are bending over backwards to promote this league, and they are ignoring all the other women's sport and also all the other sports that deserve their time in the limelight. So I was really jacked off with it, and it just, to me, it's getting ridiculous.
I agree with you totally. In fact, I've got my own little fill. Someone who's going to be missing me is the Perth Now website, because as of Monday, I'm never going to log on to your website for news ever again. I went there Monday morning, scrolled down to the sports on their homepage, on their landing page, scrolled down to the sports stories. I wanted to read the A-League Grand Final match report and see what all the fuss was all about. Oh, well, there wasn't a story there. I could read a story about the Champions League results from overnight, but not about the A-League Grand Final, unless, of course, it happened to do with a certain chef who outrates the football in the same time slot on a Sunday night.
And who owns Perth Now website?
The West.
And who owns the West?
Big Kerry.
Channel 7. And where's the which show is this chef on? What channel is he on?
Channel 10.
Okay, so they probably were quite happy then to have a go at a chef on a rival show, because it might boost the rankings on one of their shows. But then, aren't we just getting too deep into it?
Oh, look, don't be so cynical, Ashley.
And finally, the Spandau Ballet Gold Award for a great moment in sport. And this is not necessarily a great moment in sport, but it's something, John, we've been campaigning about for a long, long time. And I was really pleased that World Rugby have announced this week that they're reviewing the way things are going to, the eligibility to play international rugby. And the 36-month residency requirement is going to be increased to 60 months with effect from the 31st of December 2020. Now, obviously, there's got to be a crossover period. That's why they're allowing that. And the addition of a residency criteria which permits players to have 10 years of cumulative residency may be eligible effective May 2017. So 5 years now if you want to switch countries. And I think that's good, because if you look at how many players have left South Africa to go and play, and also now we're seeing a lot of New Zealanders, Samoans, Fijians, Tongans playing for England, Wales, Scotland, etc., Japan even, it's great. I think, you know, if you really want to commit, or you have those familial connections, then move over there, serve your time or whatever, and then show your allegiance to them.
I think it's a great move, and one that is justified. It should, you'd like to think, help promote rugby in some of those smaller nations, because they, like you say, the player drain might slow down slightly. It's up to whether that has economic ramifications for these smaller countries, because these players are often some of the biggest money earners these countries have, whether clubs in Europe and England and etc. are now going to be less likely to sign them because they won't be able to turn them into a naturalised player quickly enough. That, you know,
and then they're only allowed so many foreign players.
You're only allowed so many foreign players. Now, that's going to be an issue, but I think it's one that the sport should put up with, and hopefully to develop the game in those smaller countries and give them a greater chance to, you know, win things like World Cups. Imagine how amazing it would be if Fiji got up and won the World Cup. That would be brilliant. I'd love that.
Yeah, I mean, I look at the last World Cup, and the Springboks had obviously a team playing at the last World Cup, but then there were another whole team of players from South Africa that were playing for other nations. And that must be, if you're a South African fan, I would think that would be a little bit upsetting, that you're seeing all these players that you've developed playing for other teams.
Yeah, and admittedly, from the players' perspective, they just want to play international rugby. If you can, you want to do it. But at the same time, international rugby is not about what a player wants.
Yeah, you have to protect the integrity of the game
absolutely
as a whole.
Absolutely.
And that must always come first.
And the other thing we'll come back to that's always been an issue here is the European clubs releasing players to play for their countries. They've got no problem when it happens to be a Frenchman they have to release and they're a French club, but suddenly should it be a Tongan, they've got some sort of issue with it, and I just really dislike that.
No, it was Samoa over here in 2003.
It was Samoa.
Yeah. Well, I think that's it for this week.
Yes, thank you for your company.
Always good.
And big hello to everybody who happens to listen to us from overseas. We really enjoy that.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It's
see ya. We'll be back next week.